So, we live in a culture that is pretty great at creating unthankfulness. Teresa, thank you for helping us with good insight and good humor to touch something that's true and real about the celebration of Thanksgiving in our prevailing culture, which is that it's a celebration of colonization, which is not really, a reason for a party. And yet, what the colonists found when they arrived on this already well-established shore was plenty. And that is a reason for thankfulness. It's too bad right out of the chute, us white folks arrived not realizing that sharing was a good idea. And so now we're trying to figure that out. But I think you did a beautiful job of that, and I want to thank you. Our culture, though, the prevailing culture, I think, is one of not predominantly thankfulness. Maybe a simpler way to think about this is to observe that we are constantly being bombarded by messages that create dissatisfaction. And that's what they're meant to do. That's how they were designed. Now, primarily, we encounter those as advertising. And so, again, primarily, but not exclusively, they are meant to create dissatisfaction with what we don't have, or with what we do have because it's not the right thing. However, we're also part of a culture that increasingly over the decades has said, you are what you have. And so now if we can make you dissatisfied with what you have or don't have, we've made you dissatisfied with who you are. And that doesn't leave very much out, right? So that's what I mean by kind of a culture of dissatisfaction. And I want us to do just a little exercise this morning. Well, actually, this will actually the front end of what we're doing this morning will be fairly participatory, but just to kind of get us going a little bit. And the goal of this exercise is not to reinforce the dissatisfaction, but to become aware of ways in which we are being pushed toward it. So basically, to take back, consciously take back a part of our lives in this regard. So if you think about that culture of dissatisfaction and how it's created, the exercise initially is very simple. I just want you to think of one way that you encountered that reality in our culture recently. And if you can think of one and you want to tell us what it was, then please do. Just say it out loud. All right, so I want to connect a couple of dots here. Because I think that sometimes in our everyday lives, in a culture of dissatisfaction, like the one we live in, we also have this experience, like we might find it hard to feel as though we see or sense the presence of the divine or of God. And since we're constantly being trained to be dissatisfied, I think one of the things that happens quite unconsciously often is that we just sort of transfer that culture of dissatisfaction right over into our spiritual lives. God, I'm unhappy with my life. And I think you're responsible for that, is a spiritual perspective. As is, God, I'm unhappy with my life, and even though I get that I might have some responsibility for that, the way that I think about you means that it's your job to rescue me from whatever's making me unhappy, and you're not doing that, and so I'm not only unhappy with my life, but I'm unhappy with my God. So I've just kind of got this malaise stirred into everything. Now, I think there's a connection between a culture of dissatisfaction and our finding it hard to see God in the world, but I don't actually think it's the one that I just mentioned, generally speaking. I think that the occasion of Thanksgiving might be a good time to get a bit of a glimpse of what I imagine that connection might be. We're going to do part of this, continue to do part of this on our own, so everyone can see, and then we're going to do part of it together. So if you've got your phone with you, this would be a good time to get that out. Because we're gonna make some word clouds. Try not to fall down the YouTube wormhole while you're doing this, okay? It'll be hard. Yeah. So we're gonna answer a couple of questions. Be aware that whatever you send to as a text, since that's you can either access this through the web or through you can text. So either way, the top icon at the very top of the screen is if you're accessing it through a website, and the second row is how to access it by text. So you can answer the question. Whatever you send, though, to that contact information is going to appear on the screen. So just be aware that, you know, when you're deciding what you're going to say, that we're all going to see it. Okay? So if you're feeling especially thankful for, you know, something personal and really intimate that's not public, you might not want to send that.
But we also don't have to put our name on that.
Your name will not appear. Just the word you send. Some surprises, eh? Also, some of the things I would think we would expect to find. I think most of us would feel thankful for family, friends, water, shelter, food, things that connect to our spirit, whether that's a sense of home or intimacy or our partners or our pets. Some of us are struggling with pain, but we have learned some things about pain, obviously, if we would include it in things we're thankful for. Some of us are getting help with health or pain, and we're thankful for that, and so on, right? So that's interesting. Okay. So, Judy, why don't you take us to the next one? Now you can just really cut loose. What am I not thankful for? And just remember, we all get to see this. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Listen, an exercise like this can raise lots of questions, among them the question of agency, which we've sort of touched on in our conversation already this morning a little bit. So the question of in what sort of things and to what degree do I actually have something to do with causing or sustaining the things I'm thankful for? And what sort of things that I'm experiencing in life just sort of fall under, you know, dumb luck / misfortune? What sorts of things do I think about God or the divine as responsible for? Like, how do I deal with that whole question of agency, right? So I'm going to just suggest that, like the rest of life, a question set like that is never simple and that it's always a mixed bag. So, for example, one of the themes that sort of recurred that we were thankful for was, you know, good health. So we might say, all right, on this question of agency, I know that some of that's inherited. It's in my DNA blueprint, so I got lucky, less lucky, however we want to think about that. But if our view of the divine is that they're a personal interventionist kind of being, we might bring God into that, and we might say something like, God blessed me with good health. We also know that we have some agency in this, so we contribute to an experience of our health by our lifestyle choices. So, you know, I'm going to eat lentils and tofu and get in my 5K every day. We also know, though, that we could just come back from our 5K run and enjoy our dinner of lentils and tofu and get a phone call from our doctor that says, by the way, that DNA time bomb you've been carrying around just went off. I know you didn't know it was there. You're not responsible for it. You arrived this way, and you have 6 weeks to get your affairs in order. So, you know, we know that it's a mixed bag, right? Like, we know that this is the reality of our human experience. But for now, in the middle of all of that sort of complexity, which I think it's important to acknowledge, we've got these two lists. We've got a list of things we're thankful for and things we're not. So what I want to do now is actually mix some ideas about God into all of that. And I'm going to do that from the vantage point of the tradition the majority of us share, which is the Christian tradition. So I want us to have a look at that text that I asked you to put up, Jude. So here we go. Give thanks in everything, for this is the will of God in the Messiah among you. And I chose the particular translation I did because I wanted to kind of get as close as I could to the language, as far as we can tell, the language that was used for the text by its writer or writers. So, it's easy to get stuck in a text like this, like right out of the chute, right? We kind of look at a text like this, and we think about everything in our lives, and we think about the lists we just made, and we think, well, I'm thankful for this, and I'm thankful for that, but I'm not so thankful for the stuff on list two. And then we can start to feel like we're not living the way that we should, because somewhere along the line, we learned that the verse we just read means that we should be thankful in everything. Now, we've got that mixture of general dissatisfaction that we talked about. We've got a general kind of spirituality of discontent and this general sense that either God doesn't care or God's on vacation from caring. And either way, God is hard to locate in our everyday experience. But we should come back to the text just for a minute because it's worth observing that the directive here, if we think about the text as directive, which we might not, by the way. We might think about it as more like opt-in wisdom. But a lot of us grew up in a culture and a setting where we were taught to regard the text as directive. So, if we start there, if you look at the text as directive, the direction is not to be thankful for everything. It just actually doesn't say that. What it says is be thankful in everything. So, in other words, right from go, we are talking about a perspective. We're talking about an attitude. We're talking about a lens, a point of view, a valence on all the kinds of things that happen to us in everyday life, not all of which are things we're thankful for. That's important. And honestly, given the complexity that we considered just a moment ago, it really seems a little bit short-sighted to think that being thankful for everything even makes sense, because we know that something that we were thankful for a minute ago can morph into something we're not thankful for, like in an instant. So that just thankful for everything just seems like pretty much nonsense under that kind of examination. But it still might leave us with this challenge of thankful in everything, and the question of what that has to do in general with our spirituality. What if when we choose thankfulness as a prevailing or dominant perspective in our lives, it made it easier to see God in the world? What if there was a connection between those two things? The writer of this text seems to think that there is, because what they're saying is that thankfulness is a way that God becomes visible to us. So, I don't think we summon the divine. I think that makes the divine the same size as whatever our magic is, right? If we can summon the divine, we've got control over the divine, and who needs God at that point? Like, we're it. So, I don't think that idea really works at all. However, so I wanted to be really careful with my wording here, because I don't actually think that being thankful summons God's presence. I think that being thankful can help us to see what's already true about the world. Different thing. All right? Now, the writer of this text uses this word Messiah, which we're going to come to in a bit, but they use it about the missing, the ellipse in there is Yeshua. It's the Aramaic name for that got applied by those writers to Jesus. And so I wanted to just stop on that for just a minute, because whatever we might think or believe about Jesus, and in a room like this there'd be quite a range, it seems like a reasonable thing to observe that a lot of people felt like they saw God uniquely present in him, and that somehow seeing the presence of the divine in this person gave them some power to change their perspective on everyday life. And we're not talking here about people that had everything they wanted or even everything that they needed. Like, we're talking about people here who struggled with the cost of living, who had reason to be concerned about the duplicity, or in this case, the full-on tyranny of their government. We're talking about people who were not being accepted for who they were culturally. They were not being regarded as arriving in the world intact with their story of how the world worked. That was not the right story about the universe and everything, about their personhood. They were people who had had a long history collectively of, if they were thinking God was a divine being who should come along and pluck them out of the things they were unthankful for, that God had clearly, at least on occasion, moved over to the other team. So this is the experiences that the people are having that this writer is writing to. And these are the people to whom the writer says that thankfulness is what God looks like when seen walking around in the midst of ordinary life, including everything on both of our lists. Give thanks in everything, for this is the will, which is the active presence of the divine, in your midst, among you. That's an interesting idea. Thankfulness, the writer of Thessalonians says, is a way of looking at life that helps us see Messiah in it, not just some of it, but all of it. Now, I said we'd stop on Messiah for a minute, because for some of us, we can't hear Messiah without a whole bunch of other stuff that comes kind of trailing along in its wake, and frankly, not all of it's welcome. So, I think that idea bears just a little bit of exploring. The word itself, Messiah, means leader, or one that saves. Now, don't get stuck there. It doesn't mean from your sin or from hell. Like, that definition of Messiah just means somebody who steps up, okay? To the Hebrew people, that idea had been a long-standing part of their mythology, a very important part of their binding story, said someone is going to come and do this for us. This is a small minority oppressed group of people, and their central to their mythology is this story that said there's someone coming that's going to change the game for us. We're not going to be on the margins anymore. Super important part of their story. All right? Now, so when someone was writing to that group of people and they used a word like Messiah, that was the context. All of that came along with it. But that's not this group of people in this room. That's not us. And so to some of us, in a setting like the exploring we've been doing today, we might choose to think of that word more by its general definition, all right? More as pointing to someone that shows us a way to live that saves us from a lost life. And again, I realize that as soon as I go to this terrain, there's all kinds of stuff that comes with it, so let me tell you what I mean by that. I mean saved from a life that is lost to the things that rob it of its joy, of its hope, of its beauty, of its grace, of its peace. So we're talking here about someone that would point us to a way of life that leads us away from, for instance, dissatisfaction. Because dissatisfaction takes away things like joy and hope and peace and grace and so on. Now, the imagery that the writer of John's Gospel uses for this is to contrast a life that is being robbed versus a life that is being filled up. The text says this, and John, by the way, take me to task later if you want, but make sure you do your homework first. John's Gospel has Jesus saying things in it that Jesus doesn't say anywhere else. And it's written later than all the other Gospels, which suggests that there's a group of people who are already forming a religion who need to validate this Jesus figure in that process. And so Jesus says some very profound things in John, no question. That's also the only place where Jesus says them. Doesn't say them in any of the other stories in the Gospels about Jesus' own life, which is kind of intriguing. So this is from John, so context matters. Here's the text, though. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it in abundance, which, by the way, categorically does not mean filled with stuff. Okay? So our idea of abundance, we've been so trained to consume that our idea of abundance right out of the chute often starts with, oh, you mean lots of stuff. And that's not what's going on in this original language, like, at all. So that's important. Now, here's the other thing. So the thief in that text refers to anyone that leads people away from a full life. I don't know, how many of you, don't show me your hands, but just a quick mental review for yourself, how many of you have sat in a sermon where somebody told you that the thief was Satan? Yeah, that, never mind saying don't show me your hands. People can't help it. I've been in that sermon, right? Like, we don't have time for this. So I'm just going to touch on it, and again, we can come back if you want. We can have a conversation about it. That whole chunk of John is one piece. It's divided up in most of our English translations. It's not very well divided up. Like, the editor was having a big old day and just said, let's do this, because it doesn't really work the way it's laid out in most of our English texts. It's actually one discourse, the vast majority of which is Jesus talking about spiritual leaders that lead people away from a life that's getting filled up. It's not talking about Satan. Frankly, something Jesus just basically didn't do. But especially not here. That's not who the thief is. The thief is, in particular in this text, any spiritual leader that robs people of their joy. How about that? Right? Like, that's, to me, that's super intriguing. I can't judge them, but that's how I would have experienced that. Yes. I would have been like, oh great, there's this mythic figure who's just like lurking around here ready to, like, you know, rip the guts out of everything. And now I can fear that. Thank you. Right? Yeah. So that's really interesting. So if we take that idea and we think about the definition of the word Messiah sort of out of its Jewish context, which is not most of our contexts, what we end up with is the idea of a leader whose presence actually contributes to a life that is being filled up, not a life that is being robbed. Just for one second, think about the misbehavior of religion in culture in this regard. Why are we surprised when we stand back from the misbehavior of the church when it has robbed people of an abundant life and look askance at it. Like, this is an old idea, people. That's a thief. It doesn't matter what the name of the thief is, it's still a thief. That's what the writer of this text is saying. Those are the words they give to Jesus. That idea of Messiah, it seems to me, is profoundly different, life-givingly different from the idea of Messiah, meaning somebody who gives you like a hall pass from hell, you know, so you just don't have to go there. If we had the time, we could talk about how the research on choosing thankfulness changes our lives, fills them up. I'm just going to touch on it, and I'm going to leave it with us, because I think we're actually talking about the same thing. I think we're actually talking, when we look at the research on how thankfulness or gratitude impacts our lives positively, we're actually talking about ways in which making that choice helps us to see the presence of the divine in the world. If our idea about God has anything good in it, then it has to include the idea that God is somehow that within good, which good things are. God is love, God is peace, God is joy, God is hope, God, and so on. That within the orb that we use God language for are those good things. So why wouldn't we see them with the agency of leadership? And why wouldn't leadership be able to take them from our human experience? It's exactly what the writer of Thessalonians is saying. You want to see Messiah walking around in everyday life? Try the lens of thankfulness. This is from Harvard Health. What we find when we look at the research on this stuff is that, in general, the word that gets substituted in for thankfulness is gratitude. Gratitude's an interesting word. Big surprise, comes from a Latin root. And the Latin root means grace, graciousness, or gratefulness. And in fact, our word for grateful or gratitude actually encompasses all of those ideas. We generally take it to mean thankful appreciation for what we've received, whether that's tangible or intangible. That's how we tend to think about gratitude. And in the process of expressing it or marking it, however we do that, one of the things that the research says we're doing is we are acknowledging the goodness in our lives. And further to that, what the research says is that when we do that, what we tend to do, just quite naturally, is we recognize a source for that goodness that is outside of ourselves. Sounds suspiciously like the realm of the spiritual in general to me. That's what happens when we, research just clearly shows this over and over again. When we choose the lens of thankfulness, it takes us out of ourselves and into the world around us. Pretty interesting. And as a result, thankfulness also helps us connect with something larger than ourselves. That might be other people, it might be nature, it might be a higher power. When the Harvard Health folks provide this practical little list at the end of this article that I pulled this from about how to engage with gratitude, and they're kind of like, you know, keep a gratitude journal, count your blessings, so on and so forth, they include pray. Isn't that fascinating? It's just a way of the researchers saying thankfulness gets our head up and our eyes looking out there for this goodness that the Thessalonians writer uses the idea of Messiah. For God's will walking around in your midst. There's a crazy thought, eh? All of that to say, the glasses of thanksgiving, the lens of thanksgiving, points us to a way that we have agency in that contributes to our ability to see God walking around in everyday life, rather than being robbed of the things that come with that by dissatisfaction. And to me, that sounds hopeful. It sounds helpful. It sounds like the way I'd rather live, frankly. Anyway, peace.